All right, Mr. Coffis, I want to ask you a question. Going back to that, we got over 1 million cars we got to sell. Cars, trucks right here, they're all brand new, and we need to move them out, so we're dumping them. Because them 2016s are coming, we got to move them out. Come on down here. Every one of our cars and trucks are running wild. They all want to be purchased, okay? So come on down, buy one. I mean, for Pete's sake, come buy one. Please, Lord, let them come and buy some. So what my question is, did we build too much stuff? And people have heard this before. They go, oh, man, are you going to say that again? It's like, yeah. For years, I was listening to the radio. So housing starts are this, and automobile sales are that, and that's about all you heard. West Essex's intermediate crude is, and they'd go by real quick. And it was all about housing starts and automobile sales.
All right.
So what I'm getting at is did we wind up, is there some hidden, like, genius somewhere that's like, hey, we built too much stuff. What we need to do is get the Chinese to build the stuff that we have too much of, and then I know we'll get them to buy some of our debt too.
Mm-hmm.
And then that and way they can get our stuff in for cheaper prices and everybody will make out. And I'm just wondering about that, because it's interesting. After, like, for example, the Chevy Suburban, I noticed 1 year, I don't even remember which one it was, but it was the one before the body change. This has been at least 10 years ago. But the slab-sided ones that I thought was a pretty good-looking machine, they got all rounded and kind of modern-looking, you know. And then the other body, the old body style, that was new like last year or year before, they're all suddenly gone. You don't see anybody driving them anymore. So yeah. I started looking at this, and it seems that, well, a lot of those vehicles go to other countries. They go to the Middle East, they go to South America, they go to Mexico, they go to a lot of places. They just get them out of here in great big bulk numbers, and that's it. Make way for the new ones. I mean, even the automobile deal has been, I mean, can you think of, you talk about a Ponzi scheme, it's like all this stuff about rebates. Oh, really? You know, cash back. Oh, they're going to give you some of your own money back. And then GM did this stupid thing called a smart buy, which turned out to be a lease. I think probably they got sued for it. I don't know if they did or not, but anyway, so you buy a car. The moment that you drive off the lot, it drops 20% in value. And I mean, you have is, I mean, you drive it for a couple of years and bring it back, and you've effectively got, you know, your down payment for your next new car, so you can remain perpetually in debt with that. To me, the automobile dealings is emblematic of the way this whole system is run. I mean, you get less and less and less, and you just keep paying.
Yeah, I mean, this is really the new bubble in America. You know, these are big ticket items, cars, houses, and drivers of the economy. But it's really in quite a bubble, $1 trillion now, approaching $1 trillion. Total credit card debt in the U.S. is $850 billion. I mean, and student loans are $1.3 trillion. It's actually the biggest. So they're saying now that the auto bubble is the next subprime. They're letting anybody sign on. It's 75 to 86 months. I mean, think of that. 86 months. How long is that? I don't know. I mean, the average payment's around $500. So,
they just, 72 months is 6 years.
They're just, everybody wants, everybody's, you know, buying a new car. Furthermore, did you know 80%, maybe 80, 90% of these cars are not made in the U.S. anymore? If we lose our dollar privilege of our dollar status in the world, we could start paying a lot more for imported goods and things. So, I mean, so that's really a big bubble. 60 days in delinquent payments right now. It's approaching. The chart is just soaring up. People are not paying. They're making their payments. So it's another bubble that they're creating. And, it's just another credit bubble that they've created. You know, we talked about interest rates being reset, and, you know, that affects everybody's credit for borrowing, whether it be a car, a house, whatever. And inflation is something that's very understated, and it's very, it really is harmful, because they're mispricing the bond market and everything else by saying we only have 1% or 2% inflation per year. In fact, they say we hardly have any inflation, but we know better. The CPI was 1.8% all of last year. That's the government figure. and 40% is based on housing, but they exclude food and energy on this, you know, the kind of stuff we need. And by the way, have you noticed that the products in the store are getting smaller by weight, you know, like soup and coffee and chips and drinks and so on? I mean, they're making the product size less, less ounces and everything else. And that's a form of inflation, hidden inflation right there. They're forced to do that.
Yeah, I heard a funny story. I don't know if it's true or not. I'm trying to talk to this lady who's all over this. But it's like McDonald's came up with the name McDonald's was used. McDonald's has come up with a healthier burger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's smaller.
I heard about that.
It's actually is that a true story? Did that really happen?
I don't know.
Anyway, go ahead. It's like, I mean, what's a less fattening and deadly sandwich? I know, a half a sandwich.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but when you go in the grocery store, you're just seeing chips, especially bags of chips and stuff. You know, you're seeing less stuff put in there, but they're still charging the same price. You know, so it's just a way of tipping the scale a little bit. But the CPI, I mean, it's so rigged; it's underreported. The government downplays that because of inflation, and they don't want to pay the cost of living increases. You know, Ed Patowski is a principal at Chapelwood Investments right there in Dallas. And his firm has created what they call the Chapelwood Index. Look at this. This measures the true price index of inflation. And you can go to that website, chapelwoodindex.com, if you want to look it up, that he estimates to be running 10% annually. 10%. The CPI was 7.2% for the past 4 years, official government figures. But he says it's more like 47%. And, I mean, can I hear an amen out there? I mean, people, we all have to buy these products. The CPI is based on 8,000 items, and his is only based on 500 items in 50 major cities. So he's done this for 4 years. You can see in the chart there. But everything's going up. Disneyland tickets, you know, cereal, meat, pills, rent, utilities.
Have you gone to a rock concert lately?
Well, even hunting license, yeah. Theater tickets, for example, concert tickets. Beer. Uh-oh, beer's going up. And, of course, bullets. We know that's gone up. But here's another reason why, again, the bond yields are so mispriced, because they're not, you know, you're talking a 1.5% bond yield. You know, you're losing, folks. I mean, you're losing, you know. Inflation right now, I think it's running 66% per month in Venezuela. You wait and see that's, you want to talk about a humanitarian crisis and the failure of communism. Just like Greece, that's what they've tried to do. You know, everybody's looking to the government, that great fiction that we can live off the state. We know, for example, that gold and silver is a traditional hedge against inflation that they say is so low. But look at this CPI to the gold price index in this slide. Something happened on April 2013, and what was it? Was there no more inflation? Was there a new gold discovery? I mean, on Thursday, April the 11th in 2013, the White House called 15 banksters in, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, to a meeting. I think Obama was out golfing, and they were instructed to dump on the market. On Friday the 12th, they dumped 400 tons of gold and smashed the silver price. They did it again for good measure on Monday, which happened to be tax day. Again, so why'd they do this? I mean, look at that chart. What is the disconnect there on April 2013? ABN AMRO had a gold delivery default. That's a Dutch bullion bank. In fact, there was two of them, and that occurred in late March. So just 2 weeks later, they were smashing the market. LBA and the COMEX had huge withdrawals, gold and silver. We're beginning to see some of that right now. And they had to stop deliveries. And and there was also a deal made with the new leader in Xi Jinping of China in March 15th. So there probably was some linkage there that we would make the gold price affordable for the Chinese, you know, which we'll see in a minute. But 6 months ago, we saw the gold smash on the February 6th. See that chart there. That coincided with the labor report. That was another bear raid, time to support the government data. They had dumped 600 million ounces of silver. That's two-thirds, actually about an annual production of silver in one day. I mean, you know, this is also what they did with the silver smash, same thing in April 2013, and that slide 55 there. And most recently, just Sunday, on Sunday, July 19th, just, a couple weeks ago, almost $3 billion was dumped again on gold. It was a $50 drop. And now we have a record 1.2 billion ounces of naked shorts at the COMEX. We call it the CRIMEX. And this is a historic silver paper short. Look at that chart right there, 56. Look at the historic shorts that they are dumping against silver right now. And, you know, I think it's trading at $14.65 this morning. I mean, this is way below the cost of production. It can't be sustained. I think you had Bill Holter on the other day talking about that. So, I mean, twice the annual production against only 180 million ounces of silver, and that's 121-to-1 paper derivative. In other words, it's a casino there, because for every ounce of silver that they have eligible for delivery, they got 121 paper contracts. So it's really just it's a paper price. It's not the physical, doesn't represent the physical market. And they're doing this, I think, because of the volatility in Greece and China's gold announcement, which occurred the Friday before that. Incidentally, they finally disclosed how much they had. And then on July 7th, the U.S. Mint has had to halt silver sales for 2 weeks. This is the third time they've done that. They've been actually rationing since 2013. That's the U.S. Mint, especially on silver. The world mines 8 times more silver than gold, but it's selling 200 times more silver than gold. I mean, there is your stress right there, you know. So the U.S. Mint has sold more silver eagles since 2008 than you know, the previous 20 years. This is against their laws, their bylaws too. By the way, they're always supposed to supply the market according to their mandate. But the Mint has halted sales here. Silver drops to a new low. Lead was up 7% last year, and now we have silver down 2%. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Lead is up. Ed Yardini was on CNBC. He said these markets are all rigged, and he said, I don't say that critically, I just say that factually. And, of course, the reason they do it, it comes back to the confidence issue that they have to maintain in their industry, and that I just see the banksters getting desperate. You know, gold and silver is like kryptonite to them. You know, it's just any rise in the metals market is a signal that the warning that the economic policy isn't good, and there's risk and there's danger. And J.P. Morgan, as you can see here, they're at the center of this manipulation for years, especially since 2008. You know, they control about 30% of the naked shorts at COMEX. So CFTC won't investigate that. It's very frustrating. You know, we hear about China's gold demand, but they've had terrific silver demand as well. And as you can see in this chart, the Shanghai Futures Exchange has seen a dramatic 93% drop in their physical inventory. Now, it's gone up a little bit in January, but it's back down again. So this is, again, due to heavy demand. And interestingly, we've had some silver bullion imports. You know, I'm in this business, and, you know, we see tightness in the market, but we're importing silver. I mean, what is that about? It's up 44% since last year. And now we learn that the demand, part of the consumer demand, is also going over to J.P. Morgan, that they have a reported 350 million ounces of physical silver, if you can see that. There's Jamie Dimon smiling. He knows what he's doing. And why are they doing this? You know, analysts are saying that J.P. Morgan is playing both sides of the trade. In other words, they fully intend for it to profit when silver goes up higher. I mean, that should tell you something right there. You know, Ted Butler... right here, slide 61, let me read this. He's long complained to the CFTC about this, and he had this to say. He said, the math is pretty simple and strongly suggestive of sharply higher silver prices, given how much J.P. Morgan stands to make. While many feel that J.P. Morgan will continue to manipulate and cap the price of silver forever, the actual amount of money that the bank stands to make on sharply higher silver prices dictates otherwise. And I tend to agree with him. He says... you know, it's going to take off to the upside. And J.P. Morgan is just, that's a third of annual production or more. I mean, they're looking to anticipate the rise in the silver price. Someday it's going to break out. I think it could be forced on them through defaults at this point right now. It's really amazing. I mean, I know it's tremendously frustrating for us who are in this business, and if you're investors, but I think there's going to be a capitulation on this. You know, $100 silver, for example, where it should be or higher, would be $3.5 billion gain for J.P. Morgan, and they could use it to get, you know, to pay some of their fines over there. And you know, Butler has asked, why did J.P. Morgan, why is it above the law in rigging the market? They've been given a he calls it a get out of jail card. Well, they took over Bear Stearns in 2008, which had the largest short position on Wall Street. And he knows it's a cover-up. Ted Butler's an analyst at this, probably the best expert I know. And he says it has to be a cover-up because he's charging them with criminality, and they're not challenging him at all. J.P. Morgan, the CFTC, they're just being quiet. So it's just collusion out there. And the silver miners are really hurting. And in one of my last newsletters, I quoted Keith Neumeyer. He wrote a letter to the CFTC. He runs First Majestic Silver. And he was asking why the COMEX excludes the producers and consumers. You know, it just has speculators there. And it's the first time that I know of that the miners are trying to complain, raise their voice over there. In fact, he said we should have 120 an ounce silver or higher, 150. And that'd be a 10-to-1 ratio to gold historically. That's what it's been. And, you know, I find it amazing that the CFTC was created in 1975. And their mission statement says it's to protect market users and the public from fraud, manipulation, and abusive practice and make for financially sound markets. I mean, what a fraud that is, even, you know, to say that. I mean, they're all cronies. They're all Wall Street cronies. That's why they won't regulate their own industry, you know. And you had David Morgan on it a little while ago, and, of course, he's silver expert himself, and you know, noted that the Gold Act of 1900, and this is in my book, but they demonetized silver. You know, the banks only have gold now. I guess that's the golden rule, those who have the gold. But you know, they intervene in the silver market because it's a smaller market to do that, you know. And you can see here the total global silver mine supply value for the past 5 years. Look at that. It's $113 billion. And during the same period, the bank fraud settlements, if you can see the fraud settlements, have totaled $128 billion. There is a vivid example of the how $120 billion really is just part of the cost of doing business, you know, in the bankster world. I mean, it's enough. That's enough to build 10 Ford-class, you know, aircraft carriers, John, you know.
Yeah.
And so they're, I mean, look, they're rigging everything from LIBOR to Forex to even the U.S. Treasury market. They've been colluding against gold since the London Gold Pool days of the 1960s. And this goes back also to the Exchange Stabilization Fund, if you can see that. This was created in 1934. Exchange Stabilization Fund was created by the profits by the amount of gold that they brought in, confiscated or nationalized in 1933 to intervene in the gold and the currency markets. And they're doing that to this day. And you can see that little arrow there, part of the some of the assets that they have to intervene in the currency markets, euro and the yen, is also the SDR right there in about $50 billion. So that is, I mean, we, you know, these people are always working behind the scenes, the ESF, to control these markets because they hate gold and silver. They hate it. It exposes their fraud. You can see this image right here. They're always trying to beat it down. Wall Street is always talking it down. And it's really just a battle between good and evil almost. I mean, the Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil, you know. And gold and silver is honest money, you know. Chris Powell at Gata, he says gold is like the canary in the coal mine, and they want to kill the bird. You know, it's really comes down to a battle between the paper money and hard money or commodity money. And you know, right here, if you can see that chart there, this in my book, I use this illustration. I start out and show the four kinds of money that we have today. We have commodity money, we have fiduciary money, fractional money, and fiat money, which is where we're at today. And, of course, the earliest kind of money we used was metal, stones and nails and things like that, mostly silver over time. But commodity money needed to be real money has to be durable, divisible, portable, and scarce. And money should always be a store of value. That's fundamentally what money should serve, and that can't be done, you know, with paper money. And they made a transition to the fiduciary money, and this occurred in the Middle Ages with the goldsmiths in Europe, and they stored other people's gold and silver, and then they would issue, you know, a warehouse receipt that was payable to the bearer. That's what it said on it. And that was fiduciary meant to trust, you know. So the warehouse receipt represented, you know, something they actually had on deposit there. So that was the evolution of money. They started using those on the street. But then they discovered, you know, they could issue a lot more warehouse receipts than they had on deposit. And they could charge interest for that even, you know. So this is how fractional reserve banking really, really came about. And the goldsmiths made these loans. When they made these loans, and this is kind of fundamental to banking, that it creates a dual claim on the on your assets and liabilities, you know, on the metals that they had on deposit. The goldsmith's deposits had become both an asset and a liability. They used it as their asset, but they owe the depositors. And this is just what the bank does with your money today when you put it in the bank. That's why there's bank runs. In fact, Greece should serve as I call it a teachable moment, you know, for fractional reserve banking, the failure of fiat currencies. And that's where we are today with fiat money. The banksters, they create money out of thin air, no banking, and then they keep a fraction on deposit and they loan the rest of it out with usury interest. And there's your inflation, there's your insolvency and bankrupts and bank failures and so on, you know. You know, this really violates the Constitution, where it says, you know, we should only have gold and silver as legal tender in payment in debts, Article 1, Section 8, 10, you know, and that's how far we've come as a nation. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith said that the study of money, above all fields in economics, is one that in which complexity is used to disguise truth or to evade the truth and not to reveal it. You know, and he says, with something so important, he said the process by which banks create money is so simple, he said the mind is repelled. And so there's kind of your history of how money evolved today, John.
Man. Well, just keep rolling. I'm just soaking it up. You know, we're trying to. It's
Well, what we see, I mean, central banks, they create money. But they create it out of debt. That's why a paper money. It's a Federal Reserve note. A note is a debt. You know, here's how it works. The Treasury creates a bond. They have 22 primary dealer banks that are counterparty with the New York Fed, and the Fed writes an electronic check paid through the dealers to the Treasury. And then the Treasury sells the bond at auction. And that's how it works. And they get an override, these 22 primary dealers. And I'm talking, you know, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and Bank of America. I mean, they're all in there. And as the Treasury spends this new money, it flows into the banking system where new money is created out of debt. Incidentally, all of these 22 dealers, primary dealers of the Fed, have been named in a lawsuit now by the Department of Justice for rigging the $12 trillion treasury market. This is a two-year scandal that's been going on. And what they were doing, I guess, was widening the spread on the bonds at the auction, you know. And again, just getting a little more of the cut, you know, in what they were doing. And I want to illustrate here. This is a fractional reserve banking cycle. Slide 67. I'm glad I can illustrate this, and if people are viewing this, but at the top, you know, here you have a deposit of $1,000. Number two, you have a $900 loan that the bank makes out. And in step number three, the borrower spends the $900. He takes that and gives it to another person. He goes and spends it. Well, this cycle repeats itself into another bank deposit where they can loan $810 and then $720 and so on. This is called the multiplier effect. You know, it's in my book, and it goes out 28 times. There is where, you know, the Fed, by issuing bonds and creating money, might create 10% of the money supply, but 90% of it is out of the banking system itself. In fact, even a credit card does that, you know. So, you know, we have a debt-based monetary system. It's all been created out of debt. I just find this so amazing because some people say, you know, like we should pay down all of our debt. And G. Edward Griffin once said in his book, if we did that, he said all the ink would go back into the ink wells. I mean, it's a crazy concept that you to pay down the debt, in fact, to pay off the interest on a bond, you have to create a new dollar just to pay the interest on that old bond. So that's the pyramid that we've created, you know. And it's also why we have financial repression. They have to keep these rates low. They have to keep them. Debt pyramid in the world now is so big, they have to suppress the price and keep it down. So your deposit, you know, like I said, in the bank is both an asset and a liability. And this is how the government also treats Social Security. Again, when the money comes in, it's just spent. And the banks have taken your money and loaned it to other people. That's why it's not there. You know, in my next newsletter, I'm going to have a 25-minute video clip. And it's really going to be helpful to see that, how that works. But here you can see the U.S. dollar, for example, has lost 96% since 1913 in this chart. And in 1933, FDR took the domestic dollar off the gold standard. And in 1971, Nixon then suspended the Bretton Woods Agreement of 1944. He decoupled dollars that were held by foreigners. He closed the gold window, they call it. But, you know, we've had a fiat paper money system now for 44 years. And I forget who said it, but, you know, all fiat currencies eventually fail. You know, that's why they have to force legal tender laws on us to accept it, you know, because they say it is, you know. And, you know, inflation is not a rise in prices. You know, it's an increase in the money supply. That's the definition the government wants to give us. But it's a hidden inflation tax or a devaluation of the currency. And it's hard to find. You know, I mean, Nixon closed the gold window here in 1971, slide 69 there. And he did that on August 15th, 1971. It's almost the anniversary here. And he said, if you can see it there, he said, I'm not a crook, the printing press is. I mean, and how much is $1 trillion? I mean, a trillion seconds would take 30,000 years, right?
Well, and, if a billion is 1,000 million, a trillion is 1,000,000,000,000.
And it'd go 2.5 times around the world, if you can see that there. And I found something, an illustration that is really kind of funny, but it's called the fractional reserve universe, if you can see that. There at the beginning, it's like this illustration that shows the increase of dollars, the multiplier effect. It talks about the pre-Jekyll Island Dark Ages, the Ponzi event, the debt expansion there at the bottom. And I love it, the delusions of personal well-being accelerated expansion and eventually a Black Friday. That's 100 years of the Federal Reserve. You know, that's where we've come. Our national debt has increased so much. And like I said, governments can only tax, borrow, or print. And so they always favor the latter because it's less understood, you know. And David Hume once said, either the state ends the public debt or the public debt will end the state. And that's kind of what we're seeing around the world, especially in Greece. But you know, the Fed is right now leveraged about 78 to 1. It was just 22 to 1, I think, in 2008. But, you know, it's actually broke on a mark-to-market basis. I mean, if you really, you know, had to value the assets that it has. And, you know, we're facing a hyperinflationary destruction of our own currency. And you asked about all the zeros you can put on. Why not just take them off? Well, here's a new book by Philip Haslam. It's called When Money Destroys Nations, if you can see that, slide 72. He's an economist out in South Africa, and he saw the hyperinflation in Zimbabwe when the Marxists took over there. They nationalized the farms, and they had inflation running pretty high in 2006. By 2007, it was 6,000%. By 2008, it was 3.9 billion percent. And finally collapsed in 2009. But that was in Zimbabwe. You know, I mean, they had $100 trillion notes, if you can see that next one there. That is a $100 trillion note. And that is 12, ludicrous. That's 12 zeros. I mean, a loaf of bread was 20 billion zims, they call it, 20 billion. The central bank, by the way, it's gone out of business. They use another currency now, the euro, the dollar, whatever. But this is how fiat money destroys a nation. It's all this notion of central planning. You know, we got too much intervention. Look at Venezuela. You know, one author, Robert Weidmeyer, he said that money from hell will be the path to hell, or money from heaven will be the path to hell. You know, so it's just easy money. And so, you know, we ask, can this really happen in the U.S.? I mean, Ben Bernanke has written his book, The Courage to Act, as you can see here. And someone responded and said it was the courage to print.
Right.
And, you know, he was known as Helicopter Ben. Helicopter Ben, in other words, he just gets in a helicopter and throws money around. And he said that at a lecture in 2002. He said the government has a technology, it's called a printing press, and that allows it to produce as many dollars as it wishes at no cost. If we do fall into deflation, we can take comfort that the logic of the printing press must assert itself, and sufficient injections of paper money will be ultimately always reverse a deflation. Well, sure it will, but you know, you're going to go the way of this, what Zimbabwe did, you know. And you know, here's Bernanke right here at the printing press, you can see.
Yes.
And he's got the Xerox machine. Inflation, you know, is an increase in the money supply fundamentally. It also helps to confiscate wealth and service the debt, most of all. John Maynard Keynes, if you can see this quote here, it's kind of a famous quote. He said, by a continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate secretly and unobserved an important part of the wealth of their citizens. And the process engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction. It doesn't matter which not one man in a million is able to diagnose. And there it is. That's pretty much what we're up against. And I think, thankfully, people like Ron Paul is out there and trying to educate us on the hidden inflation tax. That's what he always calls it, too. So, you know, something we all live with, John.
Yeah, well, it looks like we're all paying an idiot tax, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, ignorance. Yeah, you know, we can't be, I always say ignorance is temporary, stupid is forever. You know, right. I mean, you've got to be wise on this. Our founding fathers, they despised paper money. They called it the specie of fraud. It's not, you know, it can't be a store of value today, and it cheats all of us. And, you know, there's a quote in the book of Amos in the Old Testament that said that the merchants make the bushel smaller and the shekel bigger to cheat with dishonest scales in Amos 8:5. Differing weights and a false balance is an abomination to the Lord, Proverbs 11. I mean, this is a description of how the merchants there, they made the container for the, smaller for your product, and the shekel was made heavier on the scales. So they were actually making a hidden double profit. And that's how the Fed makes the money supply greater, just printing more money, the answer to everything. And the consumer products get smaller, and our earnings and our savings and so on. It's just an evil system, you know. It's just it's in their nature, you know. It's Jesus called them the money changers, you know, drove them out of the temple. They had a forex currency exchange going on there in the temple. And the increasing money supply, the Fed, this has supported the stock bubble, as you can see right here in this slide, in this S&P chart. And here's another chart you can see here as well, a chart of the S&P since 1996, slide 78. And this shows how the Fed creates the boom-bust cycle. The dot-com bubble, they had that, then the housing bubble, and then you have a QE-induced financial bubble now. This debt will never be paid down. This illustrates how we've just papered over the crisis since 2008. We really never fixed anything. We've just haven't taken the punch bowl away, you know. As you can see in this slide, 79, it's seen the dot-com bubble had a financial cushion at the bottom with a rising housing bubble. That was just starting. And then the financial crisis of 2008 hit, and they didn't have a cushion for that. So it was resulted in illiquidity, which is what we're facing now. And confidence, consumer confidence, you know, is going down. And, you know, there's no cushion right now for the next crisis. That's what the BIS was saying in their report. You know, where do we go from here? I mean, recently we saw China responding to their stock market. what they put in, $480 billion? I mean, you know, intervention. I mean, the Chinese are really showing us how to do it over there. Today, we also have a massive global derivatives exposure, as you can see in this chart here. It's estimated to be about $630 trillion. I know people use higher figures, but that's the figure I found for the notional value of the derivatives. I mean, nobody really understands what these are. You know, they're called, I think Warren Buffett called them weapons of mass financial destruction, you know. So that's 10 times our GDP. And most of these, again, are very interest rate, you know, sensitive. I think that's another reason why central banks just can't do what they're doing, you know. We have more concentrated risk now on Wall Street with 250 trillion of these derivatives are held by just five banks in New York, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America. These are the big ones. Again, these are the primary dealers of the Fed, so this really, I guess you could call it a money trust. That's what I call it, a money trust, a cartel, a banking cartel, and they just keep expanding this debt, you know. I mean, in Iceland, they did let the banks fail, and they made a recovery, and I think that's what's got to happen here, you know. And look, they have no bullets left. That's what they were saying at the BIS, you know. And it's just a boom bust cycle that we see.
Are these guys protected? Is there going to be any suffering on their end? Certainly, there's going to be on our end. But what about they who have perpetrated this?
I think there has to be some hedging that they've done. I think J.P. Morgan has a lot of silver assets, hard assets. You know, like they're hedging themselves, certainly, like the Chinese are doing. I think that on the other side of a reset, that they anticipate that they will come out of that, and you know, whatever the new money system is, and take a look at that. You know, the SDR is being proposed and so on. I want to look at that. But, you know, someone said right now that our economy is an island of mediocre tranquility in the midst of a stormy sea of a global economy. We're just kind of, you know, we're too complacent. I guess they're saying there's too much complacency out there and risk everywhere. You know, it's just a confidence game. You know, it's all about ready to hit the fan. You can see here in this little cartoon I had to put up there.
Right.
I mean, that's not Fred. That's the Fed.
That's pretty funny. Merv's Manure is the one guy coming around the corner with Fed on his shirt, and Sam's Fans is around the corner there pointing at him for when the manure carrier makes it around the corner. That's funny. Well, let me ask you this, just from a practical standpoint. Home mortgages are flat. They're the lowest they've been since the 60s, they say. But who knows? I mean, who can even trust the data that comes out of these outlets? But let's say that it's true. So is this the time, because a lot of people can't qualify for them? Well, yeah, because everybody could qualify for them before, and then, whoa, here came the big tsunami of repos and all that. So anyway. Is this the time to buy stuff with cash? Should people buy anything on time? Should they buy their new cars now? And then and wait till things fall down. They're going, well, take it easy. We'll take $20 for it. And here's the title. I mean, is this a time for people to buy everything that you're going to... Somebody was saying, I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was you, but I can't remember. Said, you know, get all the stuff that you want, like now, and be prepared to be content with it for a while. So,
yeah.
I mean, should people, like, get out of all of it? Should they get out and don't think about a mortgage, don't think about a new car, buy nothing? Because then it's like, well, if they kill the dollar and then it winds up like Confederate money, well, then what? We waited, and now we don't want a car. We need a car. We can't buy a car at all. I mean, I just don't understand what the possible scenarios might be.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, you know, debt is a killer. You know, cash is king, they say, you know, in a crisis. You want to be debt-free. Strive to be debt-free. But there can be also an argument for carrying a little debt, a little mortgage on your home, for example, because some accountants have actually argued this, because you're doing what the government's doing. you're paying down your debt with dollars that are worth less. You know, that would be consistent with the housing prices that keep going up, you know, but you've locked in a low rate of return or interest payment or whatever. And so, but I think it's good to be out of debt. You know, what we're facing right now, the government can't stop the path that it's on. We need to be proactive. We need to protect ourselves while we can. I want to look at some ideas, some good ideas in regard to that, you know, before we conclude. But there was a study done by Joseph Tainer right here. He's a professor of archaeology and history in Utah. And he published his book. It's called The Collapse of Complex Societies, which is interesting because it was his conclusion after studying 18 complex societies that investment in complexity, as he puts it, generates decreasing marginal returns till it finally collapses. And he has kind of a summary statement, because this is really kind of where we're at as a nation. He said that the marginal returns from investment in complexity inevitably level off and begin to decline while marginal costs remain the same or even increase. The only way to support these costs are through more taxation and currency debasement, and eventually leads to the collapse of a society. And isn't that really what we see? I mean, that's currency debasement. So if a person is carrying or has had a long mortgage, you know, debt, if it's a small amount, I mean, they could try to pay that off, but, you know, it might be good just to pay it off later. There's going to be a great reckoning. There's going to be a different reset, I think, occurring. And this really sounds familiar to what the U.S. is doing. No matter what we do, investing, printing more money, it's not growing the economy. And he used the term complex society instead of civilization because it describes human activity. And, for example, farming skills leads to granaries and then construction and then transportation and so on. And he focused on the Roman Empire in his book and with aqueducts and so on. They had a very complex society. They had a law code and armies, and they invented cement, you know. I mean, it's just amazing. But by the 3rd century, Rome was in serious decline. Marginal return was taking its toll. They had too many garrisons, too much military overreach, led to heavy taxation. The denarius, which was a silver coin, went from, it only had 5% silver in it by the 3rd century. That's how debased the currency was. And we have to ask ourselves, right now the U.S. has 800 military bases, you know, in 130 countries. You know, we're just going down the same path. You just had Dmitry Orlov, interesting talk with him. He talked about the stages of collapse, you know, and it's financial, political, and so on. And we're just stagnating as a nation, our economy. And Carmen Reinhart and Rogoff in 2011, they came up with a study, a book, and called This Time It's Different. If you can see them there, slide 84. They studied currency debasement defaults over 8 centuries. And each time the experts thought, this time it's different. You know, we can print money, you know, and prosperity. But they're both IMF economists, and they drew on some boom-bust cycles and especially the crisis we've had in 2008. They did another study in this next chart in 2010. It was called Growth in a Time of Debt. And in this study, they argued that when external debt reaches 60% of GDP, a country's annual growth declines a small percentage. But when it becomes 90%, as seen here, it leads to negative growth and inflation. So here's a good example of Tainer's thesis of less marginal return. And this, frankly, I mean, you just saw the McKinsey reports. I mean, around the world, we're at 286%. So this idea of just printing, you know, printing money, you can't create wealth out of paper money. You know, it's a drag on the economy. We see it in Greece where they've all violated the Maastricht Treaty, which is 60% debt to GDP over there. But central bank intervention is just, it's ineffective. It's what the economists call pushing on a string. No matter what they do, what policies they have, you know, it just doesn't help. And that's why, you know, Janet Yellen and the Fed is stuck here. The ECB, Bank of Japan, been doing this for 25 years. I mean, and this could be really threatening to have assets in a bank, because Kaiman Reinhart, she wrote another paper in 2010, The Liquidation of Government Debt. And listen to this. She's argued that she was taking bank interest rates below zero. In other words, they want to take interest rates below zero. And obviously, people would withdraw their money. So Ken Rogoff came up with his argument and said we should adopt a cashless society. And here's how he explained it. He said, it is precisely the existence of paper money that makes it difficult for central banks to take policy interest rates much below zero. Getting rid of physical currency and replacing it with electronic money would eliminate the zero bound on interest rates that have handcuffed the central banks. He said at present, if central banks try setting rates too far below zero, people will start bailing out into cash. Gee, do you think so? I mean, you know, I mean, a lot of your listeners know that the Bible talks about a cashless society coming someday, and I never thought it would be based on servicing the debt. I thought it would just be, you know, lack of trust in the banking system, you know, and a run on the banks, you know, to prevent run on the banks. But, you know, they're not even allowing 1,000 euro transactions now over in Europe. And, you know, so I mean, we could see bail-ins, everything else, John. It's just, you know, that's where I see it all heading right there.
Good grief, man. Well, let's go to scripture just for a second.
Below zero.
Doesn't it say that it's going to happen? And doesn't it look like it's going to happen? I mean, I think everybody's pretty much agreed. There's not going to be any stopping this.
I mean, well, it couldn't. Yeah,
it's impossible to stop, isn't it?
And that scripture, I mean, Revelation 13:16, it couldn't be fulfilled until this age that we're in right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know. With all the technology and everything. And now, look at the argument. I mean, they want, this isn't a threat of bank runs, people taking their money out for that reason. They want to put up gates and prevent you from taking your money out so that they can take the interest rate even lower to service that huge debt. Again, as we saw earlier, look at the global debt here. Again, $200 trillion.
Wow.
And most of this is sovereign debt, you know, of government. So it'll be never paid down. And what the world really needs is a monetary reset. And we've heard that term. Joseph Taylor concluded that a collapse needs to happen. What happens is that they hang on too long. They won't fix it until a crisis occurs. And I've heard you say that, you know. I mean, just let it happen. You know, I kind of feel the same way. It's like a slow train wreck. And William Middlecoop has written his book here, The Big Reset. You can see this talks about the war on gold, the financial endgame. And, you know, and what's the endgame? It's a new international monetary system. It's what Jim Rickards talks about in his book there, The Death of Money. So in the U.S., we've had a monetary crisis, you know, in 1907 that created the Fed, 1933 with FDR, and, of course, Nixon in 1971. So we've, you know, the monetary system goes through these kind of crisis events. And Rickards said in his book, he says that the next crisis, financial crisis, will resemble nothing in history. Well, certainly. I mean, you know, look at the systemic risk. You've never seen it so large as this, you know. He compares it to an unstable monetary system like an avalanche. You know, snow keeps accumulating and too much debt. And finally, just the whole thing just, you know, releases, you know. His first book was written called Currency Wars. You can see here, that's the making of the next global crisis. And, you know, he talked about currency wars, which is real still, it's going on right now. You know, it's when nations launch what they call competitive devaluation of their currency to lower the cost of exports and boost their domestic production. But it's a race to the bottom, and that's, Japan is doing it right now. The EU is trying to devalue their euro. The Swiss unpegged from the euro. Countries are trying to do this. In fact, this realistically, this is what Greece needs to do. It would be a lot of suffering over there, but in the near term. But you know, otherwise, they're just going to be debt slaves. And even Christine Lagarde said right here in slide 89, she said, we need a reset in the way the world economy grows around the world. We need a reset. And Middlecoop said that a reset will be either well-planned in advance or it'll be hastily implemented on the back of a dollar crisis. I think it's going to be the latter. They always wait to the very end. And historically, you can see that reserve currency status of a currency doesn't last forever. As you can see in this slide, what is it? There's been six reserve currencies in the last 500 years. You know, the dollar was established in 1944 after the war. Europe was in shambles. China was backwards. We were arguably the strongest nation in the world. So they established the dollar as the reserve currency, and it's been going on, you know, ever since. But 44 years, now we have no backing at all. It's just a fiat currency, just paper, just trust, just confidence. You know, someday U.S. imports are going to cost a lot more, because if we lose the reserve currency status, we import 90% of all of our apparel, electronics, cars, everything. I mean, think of that.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I mean, I'm just going to say, I mean, Donald Trump puts on his cap, says, make America great again. Dude, I don't know. I mean, not if this happens. And it surely seems to be coming, you know. I mean, I have a new respect for Donald Trump. I really like that he's outside the mainstream. He doesn't have sponsors. He's, you know, he has his own money, his own message. He's just telling it like it is, you know. It's fun to watch. That's going to be on tonight, the debates.
Yeah, I can't wait to see that. That should be a real...
I mean, they're going to pile up on him. They're just going to pile on and say, Mr. Trump, you know.
Yeah, well, they're a bunch of losers anyway.
Bunch of losers.
And frankly, even though, what's her name, Megan's starting to look harder worse. Every day.
I used to call it a dog and pony show. You got so many dogs and ponies in it now. I mean, donkeys and elephants. And, you know, I think more people in this
debate...
How
about worms and buzzards?
You know, what's Gerald Celente say? He's a political atheist. I like that. I hate both parties. I'm more of a Ron Paul fan. But, you know, more people should mention Robert Triffin in this debate. As often as I hear people talk about the macroeconomic problems we're having, because he really stated it clearly in 1960. You know, he warned about a serious flaw in the Bretton Woods Agreement, 1960. He said the dilemma was that the nation that supplies the reserve currency, like the U.S., has to run trade deficits. We're exporting our inflation. That's our main export. And then they'll follow loose fiscal policy, which erodes confidence in the dollar. So there was the dilemma. How do you maintain confidence in the dollar if you're going to be so reckless in your fiscal policy? So we've been able to postpone a reckoning day pretty good by having the dollar reserve currency. But he said the other dilemma was that the U.S. was pledged to convert U.S. or foreign dollars, U.S. dollars, held in gold. Now, this is 1960, but he said at that time there was more dollars offshore than gold in the U.S. And once the Vietnam War started in the 60s, Nixon was forced by his advisors at the Treasury to stop honoring gold for payment. France was forcing the issue there pretty much. And let's call it for what it was. That was a gold delivery default. Foreigners, $36 billion in paper assets against $18 billion in gold at the New York Fed. And so they had to stop it. But so the IMF is introducing special drawing rights. You've heard about this going on in the news. In slide 91 here, it was proposed in 1969. And the SDR is just a basket currency. It's got four currencies in it now. It's a unit of account, the IMF. It's not used by people on the street or so on. It's between nations. But in 1961, the London Gold Pool was formed to maintain the Bretton Woods Agreement and primarily to exert downward pressure on gold. That gold pool eventually failed. It was central banks doing that like they're doing today. And the U.S. proposed the SDR at the IMF, so they came up with a special drawing right. Originally, it had a nominal gold backing, people will know this, in 1969, because it was supposed to replace the dollar that had a gold backing. Well, you know, that didn't last either. 1971, Nixon killed that idea, so it was called an SDR because the French didn't want it to be called a reserve currency. So that's that strange name they call it, but... looking at this, in 2000, the SDR was recalibrated to include the euro for the first time. And, of course, it's coming up this fall in 2015 to be reallocated there. You can see the current SDR composition here in slide 92 as seen here. This is 44% the U.S. dollar and 34% euro, and then the U.K., the sterling pound, and the yen. Of course, the IMF is going to make a formal announcement this November to include the Chinese currency into the SDR. It's highly anticipated, but that's the yuan currency, the RMB, and the BIS, the G20 meetings have been calling for a new architecture for the monetary system. They're calling it a Bretton Woods 2, you know. Again, they're trying to well plan this, but I'm not so sure it's going to make it all the way there. They need a new debt restructuring mechanism, they call it, to rebalance the global debt that we've been talking about. And the U.S., for example, has too much of that debt, and China has too much, owns too much of that debt, as we've seen. So the SDR is even issuing SDR-denominated bonds, and eventually gold and even crude oil could be priced in SDRs. I mean, that would be a major blow to the U.S. petrodollar in dollars. So we'll look at that. But, you know, another scenario here would include the SDR with the Chinese currency. And slide 93, you can see there in the red. Now, this is just a proposal, you know, just what it would look like. But the IMF just met Tuesday of this week and suddenly announced that they're going to postpone any structural change to the SDR until September of 2016. That's probably the next G20 meeting. But they're going to have a meeting in a few weeks to determine this and then the status of the yuan, including the Chinese currency. I think they're looking at the Chinese stock market bubble and things like that. They're arguing that their currency isn't freely traded enough and they need to open their capital account. And I think the big reason is they don't want to disrupt the markets on January 1st, 2016, because, you know, changing up this component here is it's giving up some of the U.S. position we've had. I don't think the U.S. wants to yield its dollar hegemony in the world. And, they're not allowing China in. They didn't do it in 2010. They don't give them enough voting rights. And so we know the Chinese have been buying all the gold, but this isn't to back their currency, as some would, you know, say that Article 4, Section 2 in the IMF prohibits members from fixing to gold, so you won't see that. But anyway, so that's still up in the air, I guess. And the second scenario would include an SDR with the Canadian and the Swiss currency here. Canadian dollars have been accumulating, but the Swiss ended their peg to the euro in January. Many saw that as a anticipation of getting in the SDR because they can't be pegged to another currency, which is another problem that China might have because they're pegged to our dollar. So, and the third scenario here might include SDR with gold. I'm not sure this will really happen, but it's it would be like the initial SDR was in '69. Rickard says it might be necessary just to restore confidence in the money system. I imagine that could be true, but the British have even proposed 5% allocation of gold, just, you know, a little bit. So anyway, these are the scenarios for that. And would this work as a reserve currency? I think it could. It would solve Triffin's dilemma by diversifying the role of reserve currencies and allow, you know, nations to peg their own currencies around the world to the SDR. And raise the status of that. So, I mean, the SDR is issuing bonds right now. The IMF is issuing SDR bonds, and you know, that could serve as a real light at the end of the macroeconomic tunnel, the problem we're having today. Incidentally, this will be effective in 2016 sometime during the year. So if they would include gold, that would be pretty dramatic. we could see gold go to $7,000 or $10,000 an ounce. And that would be just, they would reset the price. That would be to recapitalize the system. In fact, that's some of the argument used. You know, FDR did that in 1933. He took gold from $20 to $35 an ounce. That was his version of QE, and it really worked. I mean, he reflated the economy. So anyway, they'll announce that in November now. So I guess we'll have to wait for that. So either way, look at what the central banks are doing right now. They're buying all the gold. And we've been watching this since 2010. You can see
that's chart. Really true. They are buying tons.
Yeah,
of
amazing. I mean, that should tell you all you need to know about. Don't listen to what they say, but watch what they do. I mean, you know, for years they've been coordinating their sales, and now they're repatriating their gold back to Germany and Austria and so on. And the central banks have been running, I call it, a shell game with their gold. We don't know where it is. It's been leased. It's been loaned. It's been sold. It's been rehypothecated, you know, for years. And I think there's going to be some real stress at the supply line side of things here in the West, that we could see delivery defaults here at the LBM in London, and of course in New York. You know, and we know that the demand is coming in heavy from China. China's rising as a new superpower in many ways. If you can see here, they're now the second largest economy in the world in the space of 30 years. By the way, they have a labor force of 800 million. People. This year, they became the largest importer of crude oil. I think they're the number one auto manufacturer too. Whatever. So, most of the gold is going through Switzerland, as you can see there. It's going to China. Switzerland refines most of the gold in the world, I guess. And China's doing this, I think, for a few reasons. They want to help their inclusion into the SDR. They want to hedge their losses against currency loss reserves. And bonds, U.S. bonds in particular, and I think it's to force genuine price discovery in gold and silver. And by the way, this is something we really need. This is actually good news in a way, because they're moving more in a position to do that. Look at this chart here, number 98. Just since 2009, estimated how much gold China has imported. That's 8,000 tons there, by the way. I mean, some of this has gone into the consumer, the consumption, the private sector. But we certainly know that China has more than they're saying. They finally announced that they have 1,658 tons of gold. I mean, the last time we had a record of what they had was 2009, I guess. I mean, this is only a 57% increase. I mean, Bloomberg was estimating they had 3,100 tons. Pravda published a couple months ago, I had it in my newsletter, that they have as much as 30,000 tons. Compared to the U.S., 8,000. I mean, that's, you know.
If we have that.
If we even have that. I think China just doesn't want to spook the markets. They don't want to. They want to keep the price low. That was, everybody is saying that. I mean, it was, everybody knows that they have more gold. They're actually hiding it. They produce 500 tons a year, I mean, as it is. They're probably hiding it at the People's Bank of China, their sovereign wealth funds, and the foreign exchange administration they have. But the real question is, does China really care about the SDR? Do they really care about convertibility or you know, joining the Western club? I mean, you know, I think this has really angered the Chinese by this action just happened this week. So, you know, I think maybe they'd like to see the price of gold go up sooner and provide a soft landing for their economy. I mean, that's clearly part of their strategy there. And
yeah, I think they've overbuilt. I think they've I just don't think they're as good as this capitalism thing as they think they are. I don't know. I think they're going to take a worse beating than the West, frankly. What are they going to do if nobody out there can buy their stuff? You can't eat it.
Well, you're talking about real estate, you know. I mean, they have
no, I'm talking about products. I'm talking about everything that they, if all of a sudden the demand for their exports just stops, what are they going to do with all that stuff? They've already built cities all over the place that nobody's in. They just took a $3.2 trillion bath about a month ago, or it started about a month ago and lasted for 3 weeks. You know, so it's like, I just don't think these guys are as smart and can just hold on to it forever like so many people think. But that's just me, the great economist, Mr. Wells, right?
Well, hey, I like what Chairman Deng said. He goes, I don't care if the cat is black or white as long as it catches mice.
Right.
And
right.
You know,
that's a good one.
He pretty clever there, Chairman Deng. And he just was saying, you know, he's employing some aspects of capitalism. They freed up the markets there, but it's still central planning. I mean, you can see that. And this housing bubble is staggering. When we had our housing bubble here in 2008, it was 16% of the economy. Over there, I think it's like 54, maybe even 60%, if you can imagine. And the reason for that is they don't have an open capital account. They're citizens over there. They're factory workers. They can't invest in too many areas. So they're kind of restricted to real estate, and that's what they do. Well, last June, they opened up the Shenzhen Index, and you saw that bubble. So that was a parabolic rise. I mean, some in the economists were saying, oh, it's the end of the Chinese stock market. You know, like it's like a, like it's been a 10, 20 year trend or something. Well, no, it's just an aberration. You know, I mean, when you have 800 million factory workers, you know, throwing money at a market, yeah, it's going to do something. So, you know, what I need to mention that China's opened up the Shanghai Gold Exchange. This is a very important development. This will go live, by the way, in October. If you can see here in this chart, I think Jim Willey's talked about this. V has been on your program. The Shanghai Gold Exchange was actually founded in 2002. And I admire the Chinese for what they're doing. They're acquiring enough gold to protect themselves. And they want to influence the price of gold and challenge the LBMA, COMEX, you know, here in the West. This isn't a futures exchange. The Shanghai Gold Exchange is strictly physical trading. They don't have any paper derivatives there. This is good news. I mean, in addition, three Chinese banks have now joined the international exchange for the gold fix, the ICE they call it, and the Bank of China, Development Bank, the Construction Bank. And now there's 11 members of that. I love the term they use. They call it the fix, you know. But China's moving in a position to influence this, and they joined the London Metals Exchange just, I think, last week. To settle in yuan over there in London. So, and in addition, they've created a new gold Silk Road with Russia. This will be in my next newsletter. But Russia is mining gold, or gold. They are, and they're both, you know, both Russia and China are buying a lot of gold. So, here in the West, you can hardly, you know, get consumers to even understand, you know, the value. But they had 106 tons withdrawn out of their exchange last week by probably the private sector, and that's more than all of last year for COMEX. They did it in just 1 week. So, you know, this is tremendous demand they have over there. Gold is right now in backwardation. That's a weird term, and it's kind of weird when it happens, but it means that you have a contract for delivery for cheaper, but you want to take delivery now and even pay more for it. You want the delivery now. That is
sounds
that
more like
is in
retardation.
Retardation.
Yes.
I mean, so that tells you that is revealing. I mean, we're starting to see the stress at the delivery side. So look at this billboard here in China. Slide number 100. This notice that this is in English. This is from the Bank of China. You know, they're bragging that gold is going to be, you know, that the yuan, their currency is ascending, you know, and their place in the world. And they see their day coming. You know, Napoleon said when China awakes, she'll shake the world. And, you know, it's really, they are shaking the world. In 2010, China finally joined the Asian Association of Southeast Asian Nations. In this slide, you can see. And it's been renamed the China Asian Free Trade Area, or CAFTA, not to be confused with CAFTA here, but the it's now the largest trading bloc in the world by population. They're going to have a uniform exchange rate in 2016, and likely peg it to the yuan, and the yuan might likely be included in the SDR. So that'd be providing some stability there. Japan's a prospective member, even though there's some tension between China and Japan, but China sees a day, you know, when the dollar will be dethroned, and the end of Triffin's dilemma is coming, and they're creating their own alliances with the BRICS and so on, the pipeline deals with Russia, the construction bank, you know. I call it the flip side of the TPP or the TTIP here in the West, you know. We're creating trade agreements. They're creating trade agreements, you know. So both China and Russia have called for a de-Americanized world. They've said that publicly. They don't like the idea of U.S. being the global policeman and you know, running the world and everything. So lately, China's just dumped about 500 billion bonds again through Belgium. This through on Zero Hedge. I mean, that's a lot of bonds to be dumping. So that could really, you know, start to get accelerated.
I think they're forgetting something. Just like Napoleon had Wellington waiting for him, the leopard of the West. If we run out of the ability to buy their stuff, they are, in fact, going to wind up eating it. And, you know, we see what a great job China's done with their own people, and they couldn't even feed in the 50s and 60s. And their continual aggression in the region now, where they want, oh, we want these islands. We're going to get it on with Japan, you know, threatening to do so. And it's like, I think they're a paper dragon and a paper tiger. I think one good smack and they go, you know, go right back over there instead of up in our faces. I really do. However, that said, I think the weakness of the West is what's encouraging them now. I don't think it's because they're so great. I think it's because we suck so bad. You know.
Yeah.
I think they wouldn't look as good if we didn't look so bad. Let's put it that way.
Well, they might be in a better position to survive, but you know, their biggest trading partner is actually in that CAFTA trade area over there. But their second largest trading partner is not the U.S. It's actually Europe. And Europe's number one trading partner is China as a result.
What happened? Well, that's what I mean, Chuck. I mean, what happens if the Eurozone decides to go ahead and collapse? What if three or four countries go down there? You know, Greece, Spain, Italy, maybe even Germany. I mean, how much output can Germany continue?
Well, they're the engine of Europe.
They've been driving the whole thing now for
80 million people, you know. I mean, they replaced, in the SDR, they replaced the mark with the euro, principally. That's what they did. Yeah. They took out the French franc. But, you know, Germany, I mean, you know, China has currency hubs they're creating around the world, 30 currency hubs for trading directly outside the dollar, for example. And they have a currency hub in Frankfurt. Xi Jinping just spent a week over there a few months ago and created, and they have branch offices of their Chinese banks in Europe, all over Europe. They don't have a single one in the United States. You know,
What's that supposed to tell us?
What's that tell you? I mean, they're they're creating more of an alliance, with Europe. They have a lot more going there. Incidentally, this was never reported in the media here in the U.S., but they just had the recent 7th BRICS meeting. You can see in this slide here. There they are, all the leaders there, slide 102. Mm-hmm. They just concluded in July 10th and a month ago. This was in Ufa, Russia. Never heard of it. And this time it included the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. A lot of people don't know what that is. It's the NATO of the Far East. That's what the CIA calls it here. Central Asian countries, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, all those. Some are the members of the Eurasian Economic Union launched by Russia just in January of this year. That's not widely known. So they're creating quite a trading area over there as well. India and Pakistan became members of the SCO recently. And notice the guy in the turban right there in the photo. That is the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani. He just signed a deal with the U.S., as we know. And Saudi Arabia is not real happy about that. I mean, this could be a further challenge to the petrodollar in the next slide here. If Saudi Arabia or OPEC starts aligning more with China and Russia, which is, I think, occurring, you can see in the green right there, that is Iran, India, and Pakistan. They're now full members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And that landmass is rich in oil and gas, natural resources, probably the number one in the world for all that. That's why many say that Eurasia is going to prosper over the West. That's what Orlov said. And Rudyard Kipling, he referred to this whole area as the great game, the great chessboard, as Brzezinski called it. And last year's SCO meeting was held when Kerry was visiting Saudi Arabia. In fact, that was on 9/11. And that's just when, just about a week later, is when the crude oil prices started dropping as Saudi Arabia increased production or whatever. And so I think that was to hurt Russia in the Ukrainian issue. But Russia has survived this pretty well, and it's really hurting our own market. But I think the days of the petrodollar hegemony are coming to an end, just like the dollar. And, you know, George Orwell, I used an illustration in my book by George Orwell in his novel, 1984. He described three super states, as you can see here, that the ruling elites used a conflict to create emotional basis for a hierarchical society, as you can see on this map. He noted the Americas, the European theater, and then the Far East. And he referred to them as you can see in this chart, Oceania, Eurasia and East Asia, which created a triangle of political influence. That was in his novel. And, you know, this is uniquely similar to the goals of the Trilateral Commission that envisions three regions of the world, as you can see here. As you can see in the logo, it's a convergence of a new international economic order, and that's the term they use. We've kind of shortened that to New World Order today, but and then they've even shortened it to world governance because people took offense to the idea of a world government. But, you know, but that logo just kind of shows you right there, you know, that here's these three areas. And the Trilateral Commission, you know, was formed in 1973 by Brzezinski. The inspiration was his book. It was called Between Two Ages, and he stressed that mankind's gone through three stages, the religious ideas in society, and then nationalism, and then Marxism, and now he's calling for a new technotronic era. Quote, the ideal of a rational humanism on a global scale and the gradual appearance of a more controlled and directed society. Does that sound pretty good?
Yeah.
That's what we need, more control.
Absolutely. And, I'll tell you what, it's enough to make a guy lose control, isn't it? Let's just pause just for a second. That was. Do you know we just chatted for like 75 minutes, and it went by like. So let's just stop for just a second and then resume in five. Okay.
Let's do it. Okay.
All right.
Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells Program. Here is John B.